Iraqi oil minister declared that Yamani was acting in the service of imperialism and Zionism. To such rhetoric, the unflappable Yamani reacted with his enigmatic smile and unblinking stare. Whatever the internal rivalries within OPEC, there certainly was a general meeting of minds between Riyadh and Washington when it came to oil prices. The United States government, through the Nixon, Ford, and Carter administrations, consistently opposed higher prices because of the further damage that such increases might do to the world economy. But Washington did not want to aggressively force prices down. The only chance to bring oil prices down immediately would be massive political warfare against countries like Saudi Arabia and Iran to make them risk their political stability and maybe their security if they did not cooperate, Henry Kissinger, Ford's Secretary of State, explained in 1975. That is too high a price to pay, even for an immediate reduction in oil prices. If you bring about an overthrow of the existing system in Saudi Arabia and a Gaddafi takes over, or if you break Iran's image of being capable of resisting outside pressures, you're going to open up political trends that could defeat your economic objectives. Indeed, there was some concern that the oil exporters might themselves suddenly drop the price substantially and thus undermine expensive new developments such as those in the North Sea. As a result, there were discussions among the members of the International Energy Agency about establishing a minimum safeguard price to provide a floor to protect higher-cost energy investment in the Western world against an abrupt, perhaps politically motivated, slash in world prices. Washington's central objective was stability, and it campaigned hard against further price rises for fear that they would stoke inflation, cripple the international payments and trade system, and retard growth. Before every OPEC meeting, the United States would dispatch a host of emissaries to the interested parties around the world, backed up by a flood of cables that were filled with statistics about inflation and energy use, the American officials would strenuously argue against any further increases. To be sure, contradictory messages would sometimes emerge from the large, contentious bureaucracies that shaped foreign and economic policies in the United States. Moreover, on the domestic American scene, there was no consensus, but on the contrary, a series of battles that made energy the number one political issue of the mid-1970s. The American commitment to stable oil prices put it on a collision course with Iran. When President Ford criticized higher prices, the Shah quickly shot back, "No one can dictate to us. No one can wave a finger at us because we will wave a finger back." To be sure, Iran, no less than Saudi Arabia, was tied politically and economically to the United States. Yet as the government ministers and businessmen and weapons merchants trooped to Tehran, and as the Shah continued to lecture and hector Western society on its weaknesses and ills, some in Washington questioned exactly who was whose client. At the beginning of the 1970s, Nixon and Kissinger had established a blank check policy, giving the Shah a free hand to buy as many American weapons systems as he wanted, even the most technologically advanced, so long as they were not nuclear. The policy was part of the Twin Pillars strategy, established for regional security in the wake of the British withdrawal from the Gulf. Iran and Saudi Arabia were together to be the pillars, but of the two, Iran was clearly, as one American official put it, the big pillar. And by the mid-1970s, Iran was responsible for fully half of total American arms sales abroad. The Defense Department was alarmed by this blank check. In its view, Iran needed a strong conventional army, but not ultra-modern weapons systems that it would have trouble mastering and that might fall into the hands of the Russians. Defense Secretary James Schlesinger personally cautioned the Shah that Iran lacked the technical resources to assimilate so many new and complex weapons systems, but the Shah brushed the warnings aside. "He fell in love with the F-15, said Schlesinger. Still, a consensus held sway through the Nixon and Ford administrations. Iran was an essential ally with a major security role in the Middle East, and nothing should be done to undercut the Shah's prestige and influence. Nixon, Ford, and Kissinger had strategic and personal predilections for the Shah. He had not embargoed oil to the United States in 1973, and Iran could play a key role in geopolitical strategies. The Saudis, Kissinger would tell colleagues, were pussies. But with the Shah, he could talk geopolitics. Iran, after all, shared a border with the Soviet Union. The Shah had good reason to worry in 1977 about the new American president, Jimmy Carter. In the words of the British ambassador to Tehran, The calculating opportunism of Nixon and Kissinger was far more to the Shah's taste. Two of the most important policies of the Carter administration, human rights and restriction on arms sales, were directly threatening the Shah. Despite those policies, the new administration maintained the pro-Shah orientation of its predecessors. As a member of Carter's National Security Council later wrote, the United States had no visible strategic alternative to a close relationship with Iran. Relations were facilitated by the Shah's shift on the subject of oil prices. By the time Carter moved into the White House, the Shah was having second thoughts about the value of pushing for higher prices. The freneticism and euphoria, the onrush of petrodollars, and the oil boom itself were wrecking the fabric of Iranian economy and society. The results were already evident. Chaos, waste, inflation, temptation, corruption, and deepening political and social tensions that were broadening opposition to the regime. Increasing numbers of his subjects wanted no part of the Shah's great civilization. At the end of 1976, the Shah himself ruefully summed up the problem. "We acquired money we could not spend." Money, he was now forced to acknowledge, was not the remedy, but the cause of many of his nation's ailments. Higher oil prices would not help him, so why go to the trouble of challenging the United States on this point when he needed, with Carter's arrival, to bolster relations with America more than ever? The Iranian government began to surprise the other oil exporters and even its own officials by calling for moderation on oil prices. The Shah privately went so far as to tell Treasury Secretary Michael Blumenthal that Iran does not want to be known as a price hawk. Had the Shah undergone a marketplace conversion? Had the number one price hawk become a dove? In November 1977, the Shah came to Washington to meet President Carter. In their private meetings, Carter lobbied both for human rights and for stability in oil prices. As the Shah saw it, he was being asked by Carter to make a trade, to join Saudi Arabia in moderation on oil prices in exchange for the continued flow of arms from the United States and relief from the pressure on human rights. Carter stressed the punishing impact of increased oil prices on the industrial economies. Contradicting much of what he had said since the end of 1973, the Shah agreed with Carter and promised to urge the other OPEC countries to give Western nations a break. Iran had now joined Saudi Arabia on the side of moderation. With those two countries representing 48% of OPEC production, they could dictate to the other members, and oil prices would be held in check. Thus, the battle between the Shah and the Saudis was ended. The Shah had been won over. By 1978, the oil price, when adjusted for inflation, was about 10% below what it had been in 1974, immediately after the embargo. Oil was no longer cheap by any means, but neither had the price, despite the fears of many, gone through the roof. If the oil exporters no longer had to negotiate with anybody except one another over price, there were still the territorial concessions, which gave the oil companies ownership of the petroleum resources in the ground. These concessions were reminders of the times when the companies held sway, relics of the days when the exporters were poor. The very existence of concessions, the oil nations now said, was degrading. The concessions in Iran and Iraq, of course, had been wiped out by nationalization. While some concessions would remain in the aftermath of the 1973 price shock, the termination of the last great ones, in Kuwait, Venezuela, and Saudi Arabia, would mark the final demise. The Kuwaiti concession was the first on the block. The Kuwait Oil Company had been established in 1934 by BP and Gulf. 40 years later, at the beginning of 1974, Kuwait acquired 60% participation in the Kuwait Oil Company, leaving BP and Gulf with 40%. Then, in early March 1975, Kuwait announced that it was going to take over that last 40% and not maintain any special links to BP and Gulf. They would simply be treated like other buyers. And what would happen if BP and Gulf did not agree to Kuwait's terms? "We will just say thank you very much and goodbye," said the Kuwaiti oil minister Abdel Mateleb Kazemi. The objective, he added, was to gain full control over the country's oil resources. He went to the essence. Oil is everything in Kuwait. For a number of months, Kuwait struggled with the two companies, which continued to try to hold on to some kind of preferential access. Finally, in December 1975, the two sides came to an understanding, on Kuwait's terms. Gulf and BP had asked $2 billion in compensation. At this, the Kuwaitis laughed. the companies got a tiny fraction of that amount, $50 million. Once the deal was done, the two international companies still assumed that they would retain preferential access. That assumption was such in the mind of Herbert Goodman, the president of Gulf Oil Trading Company, when he was dispatched with a small team to Kuwait City to put the finishing touches on the new relationship, or so he thought. Goodman quickly found out how much had really changed. Goodman was told to his surprise that Gulf would be treated just like any other customer. Furthermore, the Kuwaitis said, Gulf would only get enough oil for its own refineries, and not for its third-party customers in Japan and Korea. But those were the markets, Goodman replied, that Gulf had sweated blood to develop. He knew. It was his blood that had been sweated. No, said the Kuwaitis, those were their own markets, based upon their oil, and they would sell their oil in those markets. Ultimately, Gulf got a very small discount on oil going into its own system, but none at all on any oil that it might sell to anyone else. For the Kuwaitis, it was the overthrow of the colonial power, Goodman reflected afterward. There was this misunderstanding. Here was the conceit of the Americans that we were loved because we had done so much for these people. This was the American naivete. We thought we had good relations. They saw it from a different point of view. They had always felt patronized. They remembered it. In all these relationships, there's this love-hate thing. Yet, he added, it was transitory. It was just that they were just about to get very rich. The great concessions in Venezuela were also being swept away. Foreign ownership was simply not acceptable anymore, and nationalization would have to come as soon as possible. On the first day of 1976, it came. President Carlos Andres Perez called it an act of faith. The country's new nationalized oil company was destined quickly to become a major force in its own right in the new world oil industry. What remained was the greatest concession of them all, Aramco's in Saudi Arabia. In June of 1974, Saudi Arabia, operating on Yamani's principle of participation, took a 60% share in Aramco. But by the end of the year, the Saudis told the American companies in Aramco, Exxon, Mobil, Texaco, and Chevron, that 60% was simply not enough. It wanted 100%. Anything less in the new era of oil nationalism was humiliating. The companies dug in their heels. After all, their number one dictum was never to give up the concession. It was the most valuable in all the world. Even if that dictum could not stand up to the political pressures of the mid-1970s, the companies would at least try to make the best deal they could. The Saudis, for their part, were no less insistent on getting what they wanted and exerted economic pressure when necessary. In due course, the companies were persuaded, and they agreed to the Saudi demand in principle. To transform principle into practice, however, took another year and a half, as the two sides argued over the crucial operational and financial questions. These negotiations to determine ownership of fully one-third of the free world's oil reserves were arduous and difficult. They were also nomadic. For a month in 1975, the representatives of the Aramco companies encamped with Yamani in Bait Marie, a hill town above Beirut. Each morning, the oil men would walk down the little street from their hotel to an old monastery that Yamani had converted into one of his homes. There they would debate how to value an extraordinary resource and how to maintain access. Then word got to them that a terrorist group might be planning to attack them or kidnap them. And suddenly the little street looked not quaint but dangerous. They promptly cleared out, and thereafter the negotiators trailed along with Yamani on his global peregrinations. Finally, late one night in the spring of 1976, they came to agreement in Yamani's suite at the Al Yamama Hotel in Riyadh. The concession was to be disbanded once and for all. It was truly the end of the era, said one of the Americans who was there at the Al Yamama Hotel that night. But the agreement did not by any means provide for a severing of links. The two sides needed each other too much. It was the same old issue that had tied the Aramco partners together in the first place. Saudi Arabia had enough oil to last several lifetimes, while the four companies had the huge marketing systems required to move large volumes of that oil. So under the new arrangement, Saudi Arabia would take over ownership of all of Aramco's assets and rights within the country. Aramco could continue to be the operator and provide services to Saudi Arabia, for which it would receive 21 cents a barrel. In turn, it would market 80% of Saudi production. In 1980, Saudi Arabia paid compensation based on net book value for all of Aramco's holdings within the kingdom. With that, the sun finally set on the great concessions. The oil producers had achieved their grand objective. They controlled their own oil. These nation-states had become synonymous with petroleum. There was just one odd thing about the agreement between Saudi Arabia and the four Aramco companies. The Saudis did not sign it, not until 1990, 14 years after it had been agreed upon. "It was very practical," said one of the company negotiators. "They got what they wanted, full control, but they didn't want to disrupt Aramco." As a result, about 33 billion barrels of oil were produced and marketed, and over $700 billion of business was conducted for 14 years, and all of it in a condition, in the words of an Aramco director, legally in limbo. While initially the oil companies were still linked by supply contracts to their former concessions in Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and Kuwait, those connections would weaken over time due to diversification policies of both countries and governments, and because of the opportunities and alternative ties that existed in the market. Moreover, at the same time that the great concessions were being terminated, a new relationship was emerging between various petroleum exporting countries and international oil companies. Instead of being concessionaires with ownership rights to the oil in the ground, the companies were now becoming mere contractors, providing services to the countries. Meanwhile, the amount of oil sold directly by the exporters themselves into the market, without benefit of the companies in their traditional role as middlemen, was increasing dramatically, quintupling from 8% of total OPEC output in 1973 to 42% by 1979. In other words, the state-owned companies of the oil-producing countries were moving downstream, beyond production, into the international oil business outside their own borders. Thus, in many ways, the global oil industry had, in little more than half a decade, taken on a completely new form under the OPEC imperium. Even more dramatic changes were ahead. Did the end of cheap oil mean the end of the road for hydrocarbon man? Would he be able to afford the petroleum that powered his machines and provided the material things he had come to cherish in his daily life? In the 1950s and 1960s, cheap and easy oil had fueled economic growth and thus indirectly promoted social peace. Now it seemed expensive and insecure oil was going to constrain, stunt, or even eradicate economic growth. Who knew what the social and political consequences would be? Yet the risks loomed large, for one of the great lessons of the miserable decades between the two world wars was how central was economic growth to the vitality of democratic institutions. The oil exporters had heretofore complained that their sovereignty was being impaired because of oil. After 1973, it was the industrial nations that found their sovereignty diminished and under assault, their security threatened, and their foreign policies constrained. The very substance of power in international politics seemed to have been transmuted by its oleaginous reaction with petroleum. No wonder that the decade of the 1970s was, for hydrocarbon man and for the industrial world as a whole, a time of rancor, tension, unease, and gritty pessimism. But change did occur. North Sea oil production began in 1975. In the United States, new fuel efficiency standards were established for the automobile industry in 1975 in the wake of the Arab oil embargo. In 1977, oil from Alaska finally began to flow through the pipeline. That same year, a new president, Jimmy Carter, vowed to make energy his administration's number one concern. But while the domestic debate about energy alternatives intensified, the largest of America's two pillars of security in the Middle East crumbled and fell. As opposition to his regime grew to mammoth proportions, a tired and sick Shah Reza Pahlavi left Iran in January of 1979. He would never return. The Ayatollah Khomeini came to power, and the change sent a giant tidal wave of panic and uncertainty surging around the world. When the wave finally spent its fury 2 years later, the survivors would look around and find themselves beached on a totally new terrain. Everything was different. Relations among all of them were altered. The wave would generate the second oil shock, carrying prices from $13 to $34 a barrel and bringing massive changes not only in the international petroleum industry, but also, for the second time in less than a decade, in the world economy and global politics. contributing to the gloom, pessimism, and even fatalism that gripped the Western world, was a 1979 accident at a nuclear power plant at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. Failures of a pump and valve caused hundreds of gallons of radioactive water to pour into the building housing the reactor. The event raised large doubts about the future development of nuclear power. To the American public, the reemergence of gas lines, which snaked for blocks around gasoline stations, became the embodiment of the panic. The nightmare of 1973 had returned, marking the beginning of the end of the presidency of Jimmy Carter. Stuart Eisenstadt, the chief White House domestic policy advisor, later said, "It was a black, dark period. There was a sense of siege and an inability to get on top of the issue." Thus, in the summer and early fall of 1979, the world oil market was in a state of anarchy whose global effects were enormous. And while the pockets of the producers and traders swelled with money, consumers were forced to dip ever deeper into their pockets to pay the price of panic. For many of the exultant exporters, it was another great victory for oil power. There was no limit, they thought, to what the market would bear and what they would earn. Some in the Western world gloomily began to fear that what was at stake was not only the price of the world's most important commodity, not only economic growth and the integrity of the world economy, but perhaps even the international order and world society as they knew it. Shortly after 3 a.m. Washington time, on November 4, 1979, Elizabeth Ann Swift, the political officer in the United States Embassy in Tehran, got through by phone to the Operations Center, the communications nerve point on the 7th floor of the State Department in Washington, D.C. Her words jolted the officials at the Washington end of the line out of the slumberous quiet. It was already mid-morning in Tehran, and Swift reported that a large mob of young Iranians had broken into the embassy compound, surrounded the Chancery building, and were forcing their way into other buildings. An hour and a half later, Swift was back on the line to say that the attackers had set fire to part of the embassy. Still another half hour later, she reported that some of the invaders had threatened to kill two unarmed Americans just outside the room. The table and sofa blocking the door had been pulled aside, and the Iranians had burst into the office even as the embassy officials desperately continued to try to make contact by phone with someone of authority in the Iranian government. The hands of the Americans were now being tied, Swift continued in a professional, almost matter-of-fact way, to the shocked listeners at the other end. "We're going down," were her last words, before one of the young Iranians, a picture of Khomeini pinned to his shirt, grabbed the phone out of her hand. And then Swift, along with the other Americans, all now blindfolded, was led into captivity. The line remained open for a long time, though no one was there. Then it went dead. Some 63 Americans, the skeleton staff that had remained at the embassy after the personnel had been scaled down from the 1,400 officials of the Shah's time, were taken hostage by a large, rowdy, violent band of zealots who were thereafter known to the world as students. Some of the Americans were soon released, leaving 50 in captivity. The Iranian hostage crisis had begun, and it transmitted a powerful message that the shift of power in the world oil market in the 1970s was only part of a larger drama that was taking place in global politics. The United States and the West, it seemed to say, were truly in decline, on the defensive, and it appeared unable to do anything to protect their interests, whether economic or political. Meanwhile, the 20th anniversary of OPEC was close at hand. Over two decades, the organization had risen from a non-entity to a colossus in the world economy, and a grand celebration was being planned for an OPEC summit in November. In anticipation, a special committee had been working on a long-term strategy. An official history was commissioned, as was a film, and 1,500 journalists were to be invited to the great event, which would be held in Baghdad, where OPEC had been founded in 1960. On the morning of September 22, 1980, the oil, finance, and foreign ministers of the OPEC nations self-confidently assembled in the Habsburg Palace in Vienna to continue planning for the Baghdad celebration. But within minutes of its opening, the meeting erupted in a babble of confusion, anger, and chaos, and the general conference was hurriedly turned into a closed session, for something else had already been planned in Baghdad. On that same day, just as the ministers were preparing to sit down in Vienna, squadrons of Iraqi warplanes attacked, without warning, a dozen targets in Iran, and Iraqi troops began pushing into Iran along a broad front, pounding cities and key installations with heavy artillery. The outbreak of war shook the Persian Gulf yet again and threw the oil supply system into jeopardy, threatening a third oil shock. The war had been sparked by a host of rivalries, ethnic and religious, political and economic, ideological and personal, by a struggle for primacy in the Gulf, by the insecurities of national cohesion, and by the arbitrary way in which nations and borders had been overlaid on the map of the defunct Ottoman Empire and the Middle East. Khomeini himself was filled with a hatred of the Iraqi regime. His ire was focused on the president, Saddam Hussein. Certainly, Hussein had proved himself a champion conspirator in the considerable history of Ba'athist conspiracies. The Ba'athist movement itself grew out of an Arab students' union that two Syrian intellectuals had formed while studying at university in Paris in the early 1930s. A decade later, they launched the Ba'ath or Renaissance Party back in Damascus. It was militantly pan-Arabic, aiming to create a single Arab nation, and fervent in its denunciations of the West and imperialism, all embracing in its ideology and demands. It was contemptuous and unreservedly hostile to its opponents and those who were outside its grouping. It celebrated violence and absolutism in pursuit of its objectives. The party split into two branches, one of which eventually took power in Syria and the other in Iraq. Despite their common origins, they became seemingly irreconcilable rivals for preeminence. It was during the tumult and enthusiasm that accompanied Nasser's victories at Suez in 1956 that Saddam Hussein, while still a teenager, was recruited into the Ba'ath Party. The Nasserite anti-imperialistic rhetoric of the 1950s remained with him ever after. In 1959, he had been one of the assailants in the assassination attempt on Baghdad's main street on Iraq's ruler Abdul Karim Qasim. The attack failed, and Hussein, wounded in the gunfire and under a death sentence, fled to Egypt. He did not return to Iraq until 1963. Thereafter, he took charge of organizing the Ba'athist Party's underground militia. Though already the strongman for several years in the Ba'athist regime that took power in 1968, he assumed the presidency, replacing Ahmad Hassan al-Bakr, cousin of his uncle, only in 1979, in the course of a purge in which many members of the Ba'athist Party were executed. In order to assure that the imprisoned Ba'athists provided the appropriate confessions before their executions, Saddam Hussein took some of their families hostage. By 1979, he had already long since come to be seen as a shugaya, an implacable tough, a man to be feared. He was ruthless and emotionless when it came to those he considered as enemies, threats, obstacles to his objectives, or simply useful or convenient to run over. Hussein saw Iran as vulnerable. He expected a quick victory from which Iraq would emerge as the new leader and militant champion of the Arab world, a dominant oil power and the dominant power in the Persian Gulf. But Iran resisted fiercely, throwing human wave assaults at the Iraqi invaders. Hundreds of thousands of young people drawn by the Shiite vision of martyrdom, some even arriving at the front carrying their own coffins. The war would drag on for 8 years. In 1982, another major shift occurred in the balance of oil power. For the first time, non-OPEC production overtook OPEC's output. Oil from Alaska, the North Sea, Russia, and new discoveries in Mexico had turned the tide. Suddenly, there was too much OPEC oil on the market, and their price was too high. In response, OPEC established quotas. In 1983, crude oil was introduced as a futures contract on the New York Mercantile Exchange, known as the NYMEX. A stream of American crude called West Texas Intermediate became the new bellwether for the global industry. This was one key feature of a major restructuring of global markets and a wholesale corporate reorganization of oil companies. Takeovers, restructuring, and mega-mergers spread through the industry, changing the corporate landscape radically and eliminating some of the industry's major players, including Gulf Oil. These changes in oil production, in market strategies, and in the makeup of the major players added up to a dramatic shift in the world economy. The issues on the agenda at the 1985 Bonn Economic Summit primarily concerned trade relations among the industrial countries, protectionism, the dollar, accommodating Japan's economic challenge. Oil and energy, the preeminent issues of the 70s, were not on the table at all. Oil no longer seemed to need any special tending. It was just another commodity. Half the equation that had contributed to a buoyant economic growth in the 1960s, secure oil supplies, appeared to be coming back into place. The other half, however, was not there. Oil was still not cheap. Not yet. By the middle 1980s, the price of oil was balanced precariously. So much was at stake that all eyes fastened on its every twitch and twinge. As the president of Esso Europe said in 1984, "Today the price of oil is the chief variable in our equation and the greatest single source of uncertainty about the future." Would the price begin to go up again? Would it languish or would it plummet? As the months marched on, "How low can it go?" became a refrain heard more and more around the world. Not only in energy companies, but also in financial institutions and the corridors of government, and everywhere, for good reason. The answer would have a profound impact on the oil companies, of course, but beyond that it would determine the future vigor of oil power in world politics and would mightily affect global economic prospects and the shifting balance of world economic and political strength. High prices would favor the oil exporters from Saudi Arabia to Libya to Mexico to the Soviet Union. The USSR depended on oil, along with natural gas, for most of the hard currency that it used to purchase the Western technology it desperately needed for economic modernization. Low prices would favor the oil-importing countries, including the two economic powerhouses, Germany and Japan. In between and uncertain was the United States. It had interests on both sides of the divide. It was the world's largest importer and consumer of oil, and yet it was also the world's second-largest producer of oil, and a good part of its financial system had cast its fate with high oil prices. If push came to shove, on which side would the United States line up? Despite its becoming even more restrictive in 1984, OPEC's new quota system was not working. Non-OPEC production continued to grow. Coal, nuclear power, and natural gas were still taking markets away from oil, and conservation was still shrinking demand. Inevitably, as the various OPEC exporters watched their revenues dwindle, quota cheating among them became more obvious. If they could not attain their revenue ambition on price, then they would discount and try to make it on volume. The force of the market could not easily be resisted. By the middle 1980s, OPEC was faced with a critical choice. It could cut price, but where would a falling price stop? Or it could continue to prop up the price. But if it did that, it would be holding up an umbrella under which non-OPEC oil, competing energy sources, and conservation would all flourish, guaranteeing itself a shrinking market share. To make matters worse, more oil would be coming out of the OPEC countries themselves. As was often the case, much depended on the Saudis. In 1983, Saudi Arabia had explicitly taken on the job of swing producer, varying its output to support the OPEC price. But by 1985, the costs, relative to those of the other producers, were becoming disproportionately high. Defending price meant a huge drop in output, and a vast loss of market share, and a huge fall in revenues. The high point of earnings for Saudi Arabia was $119 billion in 1981. By 1984, its revenues had fallen to $36 billion, and they would fall further to $26 billion in 1985. Meanwhile, like the other exporters, Saudi Arabia had embarked on a great spending and development program, which now had to be cut back dramatically. The country started to run a large budget deficit, and foreign reserves were being drawn down. So unsettling was the situation that the promulgation of the national budget was indefinitely postponed. The loss of market had another consequence. It was reducing Saudi Arabia to a more marginal role on the world stage. The rapid fallaway in political influence and significance, and the likelihood of further erosion, ran counter to the fundamental precepts of the kingdom's security policy at a time when the Iran-Iraq war was threatening the region and the Ayatollah Khomeini continued to pursue his vendetta against Saudi Arabia. It also reduced Saudi influence on Middle Eastern politics and the Arab-Israeli dispute and on the Western industrial countries. Oil power was losing its meaning. The Saudis sent out warning after warning to the other OPEC countries and to the non-OPEC producers. It would not continue to accept the loss of market share. It would not indefinitely tolerate and underwrite quota violations by other OPEC countries and increased production by the non-OPEC nations. It could not be counted on to be the swing producer. If need be, Saudi Arabia would flood the market. Did these warnings add up to a serious threat, a clear indication of intention, or were they only a bluff intended to frighten? At times in the summer of 1985, Saudi oil output fell below that of the British sector of the North Sea. Here was the last outrage. To the Saudis, it meant that they were propping up the price so that the British could produce more, while Prime Minister Thatcher continued to celebrate her attachment to free markets and to advertise her indifference to whether oil prices were high or low. An even greater threat was closer to home. The Iraqis were reconstructing their export capacity, expanding and adding new pipelines, some of them passing through Saudi Arabia. Whatever else happened, large additional volumes of Iraqi oil would soon be pushing their way into the already congested market. The situation was untenable. Something had to give, and again, as in the 1970s, it would be price, but in the opposite direction. Still, how low would it go? A shade from the past was rising again, the prospect of an all-out price war. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, John D. Rockefeller and his colleagues had many times instituted a good sweating against their competitors. They had flooded the market and cut the price. Competitors were forced to make a truce according to the rules of Standard Oil, or, lacking the staying power of Standard Oil, they would be driven out of business or taken over. Circumstances were, of course, wholly different in the mid-1980s, yet they were not so different after all. Once again, a good sweating was at hand. The Saudis moved from a defensive price to a defensive volume, their own desired level of output, and chose an ingenious weapon, netback deals with the Aramco partners and with other oil companies, strategically located in key markets. Under such netback deals, Saudi Arabia would guarantee a fixed profit to refiners, which would allay their concerns about selling price. But increasing volume and reduced concern about the selling price would add up to a perfect recipe for falling prices. The Saudis, for their part, hoped that what they lost because of lower prices, they would make up and then some with higher volumes. But the Saudis were also careful not to be too confrontational. Their aim was to regain their quota level and no more, and they put a cap on the volume that would be covered by their new netback deals. In so doing, they were aiming their new policy as much at other OPEC members, which had been cheating and thus taking away their market share, as at the non-OPEC countries. The netback contracts obviously meant that there was no longer an official Saudi price. The price would be whatever oil fetched in the market. And that meant there would no longer be an OPEC oil price. As word circulated around the global marketplace in late September and early October of 1985 about the Saudi netback deals, nervousness and anxiety rose. Yet once the Saudis had committed themselves to a market share strategy, other exporters started to follow suit out of pure competitive self-defense. Netback deals began to proliferate. Was the price now posed for a great fall? Most of the exporters thought so, but they expected no more than a drop to $18 or $20 a barrel, below which they thought production in the North Sea would not be economical. On that, they were mistaken. Surely, many thought, the Saudis really did not mean what they were saying. It was merely an elaborate warning designed to scare the other OPEC countries and restore discipline. In early December of 1985, OPEC met yet again. By its actions, Saudi Arabia had already, in effect, declared a war for market share against the other OPEC countries. Now, OPEC as a group, including Saudi Arabia, announced the intention to battle non-OPEC to regain lost markets. The communique from the conference contained the new formula. OPEC was no longer protecting price. Now its objective was to secure and defend for OPEC a fair share in the world oil market consistent with the necessary income for member countries' development. Yet how significant, really, were these words? When, on December 9th, the text of the communique was carried into a room where senior planners of an OPEC country were meeting to talk about the future, one of them said dismissively, "Oh, it's just another OPEC winter communique." Then the price began to collapse. What ensued was no less turbulent and dramatic than the crises of 1973-74 and 1979-81, the first two oil shocks. West Texas Intermediate plummeted by 70% over the next few months, down to $10. Some Persian Gulf cargoes sold for less than $6 a barrel. In the two previous shocks, marginal losses and disruptions of supply had been enough to send prices shooting up. Here, too, the actual variation in volume was also marginal. But the consequences ran in the opposite direction. Now the exporters were the ones scrambling for markets rather than buyers for supplies. and buyers rather than sellers were playing leapfrog, each jumping over the other in pursuit of the lowest price. This unfamiliar situation once again threw up the question of security, but in new dimensions. One was security of demand for the oil exporters, that is, guaranteed access to markets. For consumers, it seemed that all the concerns of the 1970s about security of supply were being made irrelevant in the battle for market share. But what of the future? Would cheap imported oil undermine the energy security so laboriously rebuilt over the preceding 13 years? It was not merely that prices were collapsing. They were also out of control. For the first time in memory, there was no price-setting structure. There was not even an official OPEC price. The market was victorious, at least for the time being. Price would be set not through an arduous negotiation among OPEC countries, but through thousands and thousands of individual transactions. Netback deals, spot deals, spotback deals, barter deals, processing deals, topping off deals, this deal and that deal, there seemed to be no end to the variations and twists and discounts adopted as exporters fought to hold on to and regain markets. But it was not the specific kind of deal, netbacks or whatever, that caused the price collapse, but rather the fundamental facts that more oil was seeking markets than there were markets for oil, and that the hand of a regulator, in this case OPEC, and in particular Saudi Arabia, was removed. Shock was the universal reaction throughout the oil world. Would OPEC do anything? Could it? The organization was bitterly divided. Iran, Algeria, and Libya wanted OPEC to adopt a new and much lower quota, and thus to restore price to $29 a barrel. The high-volume countries, principally Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, remained committed to regaining market share, though almost plaintively, Yamani felt compelled to blame things on the buyers, telling an executive of one of the major companies, "I never sold a barrel someone didn't want." Meanwhile, Iran and Iraq, two of the key OPEC members, were still locked in a death struggle, and Iran's hostility to the Arab exporters was unmitigated. The non-OPEC countries were suffering no less in their lost revenues. Belatedly, they took OPEC's warnings more seriously and started a dialogue, which yielded almost nothing of substance. Thus, with little meeting of minds both within OPEC and between OPEC and non-OPEC, the good sweating continued through the spring of 1986. Once the industry had assimilated the reality of the shock, it responded with quick and massive cuts in expenditures. Consumers were, of course, jubilant. All their fears about a permanent oil shortage were now laid to rest. Their standard of living and lifestyles were no longer at risk. After the years of huffing and puffing, oil was cheap again. The prophecies of doom had been a mirage, it seemed, and oil power was a harmless and empty threat. The gas wars at the corner filling stations, which had supposedly disappeared with the 1950s and 1960s, were now back, but writ large as a global oil war. And how low could prices really go? The irreducible minimum was indubitably established at Billy Jack Mason's Exxon station on the north side of Austin, Texas, on a one-day promotion in early April 1986, sponsored by a local country music station. Billy Jack's price for unleaded that day was 0 cents a gallon. Free. It was a deal that could not be beat, and the result was a stampede. By 9 o'clock in the morning, the line of cars waiting for their fill-up stretched for 6 miles. Some people had driven from as far away as Waco. "The thing you got to do is create a little action," explained Billy Jack. And when his opinion as an oil expert was sought on the future of prices, Billy Jack declared, "That's overseas. Nothing we can do about that until the Arabs get the prices right." Another Texan, an adopted one, agreed with Billy Jack Mason that it was up to the Arabs, at least to a large degree. He was the vice president of the United States, George Bush. And while Billy Jack was selling his gasoline for 0 cents a gallon, Bush was preparing to leave on an overseas mission to the Middle East to discuss security issues, but also, among other things, oil. A visit to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states had been on his schedule for several months, predating the collapse. But now he was going at a time when the domestic American oil and gas industry, the oil exporters, consumers, America's allies, all were asking the same question. Was the United States government going to do anything about the price collapse? By timing and position and by his own history, Bush became the point man for the dilemmas of the Reagan administration and U.S. policy, at this very delicate moment in international relations. A few years later, on the eve of his own inauguration as president in 1989, Bush would say, "I put it this way. They got a president of the United States that came out of the oil and gas industry, that knows it and knows it well." He knew in particular the risk-taking, deal-making world of the independent oil men, who were the backbone of exploration in the United States, and who were the ones knocked flat on their backs by the price collapse. That had been the world in which he had spent his formative years. On graduating from Yale in 1948, Bush had passed up the obvious jobs on Wall Street for someone of his background. After all, his father had been a partner in Brown Brothers Harriman before becoming senator from Connecticut. Then, having failed to be called back after a job interview with Procter & Gamble, he packed up his red 1947 Studebaker and set off for Texas, first Odessa, then its neighbor Midland, which would soon be calling itself the oil capital of West Texas. He began at the bottom as a trainee charged with painting pumping equipment, and then graduated to itinerant salesman, driving from rig to rig, inquiring of the customer what size drill bit he needed and what kind of rock he was drilling through, and then asking for the order. Bush was an Easterner with what some would have called a patrician background, but he was not entirely atypical. There was a noble tradition of Easterners coming to seek their fortunes in Texas oil, beginning with the Mellons and the Pews at Spindletop, the first big Texas gusher in 1901, and continuing through what Fortune magazine once called the swarm of young Ivy Leaguers, who, Bush among them, in the post-World War II years, had descended on an isolated West Texas oil town, Midland, and created a most unlikely outpost of the working rich, as well as a union between the cactus and the ivy. It was not coincidental that the best men's store in Midland, Albert S. Kelly's, dressed its customers almost exactly the way that Brooks Brothers did. Soon enough, in this little world, as Bush later said, he caught the fever and formed an independent oil company in partnership with other ambitious young men no less eager to make money. "Somebody had a rig, knew of a deal, and we were all looking for funds," one of his partners said. Oil was the thing in Midland. They wanted a name that would be memorable. Another partner suggested that it should start either with an A or a Z, so it would be first or last in the phone book, but not get lost in the middle. The film Viva Zapata, with Marlon Brando in the role of the Mexican revolutionary, was playing in Midland, so they called their company Zapata. Bush quickly mastered the skills of the independent oil man flying off to North Dakota in atrocious weather to try to buy royalty interests from suspicious farmers, combing courthouse records to find out who owned the mineral rights adjacent to new discoveries, arranging for a good drilling rig crew as quickly and as cheaply as possible, and of course making the pilgrimage back east to round up money from investors. Eventually, the partners amicably split Zapata in two, and Bush took the offshore oil service side of the business, making it one of the pioneers and leaders in the dynamic development of offshore drilling and production in the Gulf of Mexico and around the world. By the mid-1960s, Bush had decided he had made sufficient money. His father had been a senator for 10 years, and he would head in the same direction. He gave up the oil business for politics. The Republican Party was just then getting started in Texas, but the Democrats' perennial lock on the state was not the only political problem to be faced. The would-be reconstituted Republican Party was under assault from the right, and at one point Bush had to defend himself against the charge from the John Birch Society that his father-in-law was a communist, on grounds that the gentleman happened to be publisher of the unfortunately named woman's magazine, Red Book. Bush went from county chairman to Congress. His associates from his Midland days remained among his closest friends thereafter. As a congressman from Houston, he was supposed to stand up for the oil industry, which he resolutely did. But oil was hardly uppermost on his political agenda once Bush moved on to other jobs, from ambassador to the United Nations, to chairmanship of the Republican National Committee during Watergate, to United States envoy to the People's Republic of China, to head of the CIA, and then to 4 years of campaigning unsuccessfully for the Republican nomination for the presidency. In 1980, to his surprise, Bush was chosen by Ronald Reagan as his running mate, which led him to the vice presidency. Unlike Jimmy Carter, who made energy the centerpiece of his administration, Ronald Reagan was determined to make it a footnote. The energy crisis resulted mainly, he maintained, from regulation and the misguided policies of the United States government. The solution was to get the government out of energy and return to free markets. Anyway, he had said during the campaign, there was more oil in Alaska than in Saudi Arabia. One of the very first acts of the Reagan administration was to speed up the decontrol of oil prices that the Carter administration had started. In its shift to a policy of benign neglect toward energy, the new administration, to be sure, was helped by what was happening to the world oil market. Jimmy Carter's misfortune, rising oil prices, had been transmuted into Ronald Reagan's good fortune, for just around the time that he moved into the White House in 1981, half a decade before the price collapse, the inflation-adjusted price of oil actually started its long slide in the face of rising non-OPEC supply and falling demand. Not only did the decline in the real price remove energy as a dominant issue, it also served as a major stimulus to renewed economic growth and to the decline in inflation, two key features of the Reagan boom. Of course, the free market approach rested upon a contradiction. After all, a cartel, OPEC, was preventing a big fall in the price of oil, thus providing the incentives for conservation and energy development in the United States and elsewhere. But this contradiction remained latent and untroubling until the price collapse of 1986. What was unleashed that year, in the words of the acting Secretary General of OPEC, was nothing less than absolute competition. And the results were devastating to the American oil industry. Pink slips were flying out at an awesome rate. Drilling rigs were stacking up throughout the oil patch, and the financial infrastructure of the Southwest was quaking as the region headed into an economic depression. Moreover, if prices stayed down, United States oil demand would shoot up, domestic production would plummet, and imports would start flooding in again as they had in the 1970s. Perhaps when it came to market forces, there could be too much of a good thing. Still, there was not much that the United States government could do, even if so moved, in the face of those powerful forces of supply and demand. One possibility was to slap on a tariff and so protect domestic energy production and continue to provide an incentive for conservation. While there were many calls in 1986 for a tariff, none of them came from the Reagan administration. Another option was to try to jawbone OPEC into getting its act together again. Thus did George Bush's long official inattention to oil abruptly come to an end. Who else in the Reagan administration could better talk out of his own long experience to the Saudis about oil? In its early planning, the main objective of Bush's trip to the Persian Gulf amid the apparently interminable Iran-Iraq war had been to underline United States support for the moderate Arab states in the region. But one could hardly be expected to go to Saudi Arabia and not discuss oil, especially when its price had fallen below $10 a barrel. Had the tables turned? In the 1970s, senior American officials had trooped to Riyadh to ask the Saudis to help keep prices down. Now in 1986, would the Vice President of the United States go to Saudi Arabia to ask them to push the price up? Certainly, Bush felt that enough was enough. Conditions were as bad or worse in Texas and in the industry than any he had seen during his own days as an oil man. Nor was Bush alone with his concerns in the Reagan administration. Energy Secretary John Harrington was warning that the fall in oil prices had reached the point of threatening national security, but the two belonged to a minority in the administration. In early April 1986, on the eve of his trip, Bush said that he would be selling very hard to persuade the Saudis of our own domestic interest and thus the interest of national security. I think it is essential that we talk about stability and that we not just have a continued free fall like a parachutist jumping out without a parachute. He ritualistically acknowledged the central free market precept of the Reagan administration. Our answer is market, market. Let the market forces work, he incanted. But he added, I happen to believe and always have that a strong domestic U.S. industry is in the national security interests, vital interests of this country. Bush was clearly saying that market forces had gone too far, and he was quickly and embarrassingly disavowed by the Reagan White House, whose spokesman declared, The way to address price stability is to let the free market work. The White House pointedly said that Bush would stress to King Fahad that market forces, not politicians, should determine price levels. Bush's first stop was in Riyadh, where he dedicated the new United States Embassy building. At a dinner with several ministers, including Yamani, the talk, of course, dealt in part with oil, and Bush commented that if prices remained too low, pressure would build in the United States Congress for a tariff, and it would become increasingly difficult to resist that pressure. The Saudis took his remark very seriously. The vice president stopped next in Dahran, in the eastern provinces, where the king was temporarily in residence. The American party was entertained at a banquet in the king's eastern palace, served by waiters who wore swords and pistols on their belts and had cartridges strapped across their chest. Their rifles, to the relief of the American Secret Service, were parked along the wall. A private meeting with the king had been scheduled for the following day, but the Americans were told after the banquet that it had been moved up in the aftermath of an Iranian attack on a Saudi tanker. Bush was summoned into a late-night session with the king, which went on until well after 2 a.m., and altogether lasted more than 2.5 hours. The Saudis were jittery about Iran's military advances and threats, and the prime subject of the meeting, as of the entire Bush mission, was Persian Gulf security and United States weapons supplies. Oil was mentioned only glancingly, but according to American officials, Fahad did express his hope for stability in the market. The officials added that the king felt Saudi Arabia was, in non-royal language, being given a bum rap in stories about its role in the oil market. Though courting criticism at home, the vice president stuck to his position on oil prices. "I know I'm correct," he said after his visit with the king. "Some things you're sure of. This I'm absolutely sure of, that low prices would cripple the domestic American energy industries with serious consequences for the nation." At a breakfast with American businessmen in Dahran a day later, Bush declared, "There is some point at which the national security interest of the United States says, hey, we must have a strong, viable domestic industry. I've felt that way all my political life, and I'm not going to start changing that at this juncture. I feel it, and I know the President of the United States feels it." Bush prided himself on loyalty, and he had proved over the previous 5 years to be a very loyal vice president. Never before had he departed from the White House line, but now he apparently had, and the adverse reaction became more explicit. "Poor George," was the way a senior White House official disparagingly talked about him, adding that Bush's position was not administration policy. But Bush refused to retreat much. "I don't know that I'm defending the U.S. oil industry. What I'm doing is defending a position that I feel very, very strongly. Whether that's a help politically or whether it proves a detriment politically, I couldn't care less." The general view was that Bush was making not merely a blooper, but an enormous blunder, one that could in itself damage his political ambition, and that pointed to a tendency to self-destruct. His gleeful opponents for the Republican nomination for the presidency